You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 1st, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Robert Kennedy Jr. on why the Arabs don't want us in Syria. Also on the program, Tina Dupuy will stop by to announce the launch of her podcast that we had talked about so long ago. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Tuesday, March 1st, or what we call around here, Super Tuesday. Why do we call it super? Because there are so many primaries and caucuses happening around the country that it's super. Alabama, Alaska, American Samoa, Arkansas, Colorado.
It's true.
Democrats abroad, Georgia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Tennessee. Texas is a big one. Vermont, Virginia, Wyoming. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, most of those are for both Republicans and Democrats. Not all, but I would say 90% of those. So tonight, we will, I don't know that we'll find out anything about the race, but I definitely think that if Ted Cruz doesn't win Texas, that may be it for Ted Cruz. I don't think he'll leave the race, but, well, we'll talk about all this later.
Joe is there.
God would never allow it. Meanwhile, it is the Republican Party's come-to-Jesus moment. 7-8 months ago, we said, this might be a great opportunity for the Beltway media to realize what the Republican Party has become. And it seems like, in some ways, there are Republicans who are expressing that sentiment even before the media has caught on. Meanwhile, Mississippi governor announces, finally, April Confederacy Heritage Month. Man, it's been what now? Well, 175 years or so? Not quite.
Never got credit we deserve.
Finally, we're going to learn about the Confederacy in Mississippi.
Well, it used to be that every month was...
That's right.
But now they had to change it to only 1 month, so it's really...
I don't get the sense that what they're doing is they're saying we're going to contract all of the heritage into 1 month.
Yeah, they're going to consolidate it.
Yes. Unbelievable. Meanwhile, a federal judge in New York has ruled in favor of Apple against the FBI, but not in the San Bernardino case, in a drug case. We will get to that in a moment. First, I should tell you that Casper Mattresses, our sponsor today, are obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now you can get $50 off any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority and then use the code majority. I've mentioned this before. The average person spends about a third of your life sleeping. If you have children, that number goes down to about 1/16th of your life sleeping. And if you've done it like I did it, where you spread out like 8 years between your two kids, forget it. But it's still nice to have a comfortable bed for those 5 minutes a day that you get to sleep. And you want to do it on a great mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and better days. Latex foam and memory foam. So they got just the right sink and just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. And here's the amazing part. They have a risk-free trial and return policy. They deliver it right to your house, the mattress. You get to sleep on it for 100 days. Or in my case, just lie awake and wonder if the kids will go to sleep or if you have to bring one kid in or whatnot. But if you're not happy with it, they'll pick it back up. When you go to a mattress store, what do you get? Like 3 minutes? And then they start looking at you like, what are you doing? Moving in here? You lie down on the mattress and they look at you like you've got some type of problem. Honestly, it's awkward.
Look, it's a mess, frankly.
Listen to these prices. You actually get to sleep on the mattress and they bring it to your house. How could this be better? It's $500 for a twin size mattress, $950 for a king size mattress. Those are good prices.
Yeah.
Kelly is just shocked.
Those are incredible prices.
People in New York don't get king size mattresses. Or maybe some. Kelly's now starting to cry. You get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code majority. Terms and conditions, of course, apply. They always do, folks. They always do. This is pretty amazing. Bernie Sanders raised $42 million in February.
Cash money.
This is really, it's stunning. In January, he raised something like $20 million. And at that time, I remember thinking, like, this is crazy, because in the last quarter of 2015, Clinton raised something like $36 million. Sanders raised something like $31 million. And so after January, I was like, he's on pace to double last quarter. And now he's already doubled the last quarter in 2 out of 3 months of the first quarter. Can't even believe I did all that math in my head right there. So it's pretty stunning. We're going to talk more, obviously, about previewing tonight, but the polls show him up only in Vermont and Oklahoma at this point. There is a really Byzantine process in which delegates are awarded over this. I mean, put aside the whole superdelegates thing, because I think that is overblown. I do not think that the winner of the majority of delegates is not going to end up accruing those superdelegates. They can commit and they can say, it's just an endorsement at this point. The idea that either candidate would win because of the superdelegates, highly unlikely, in my opinion. I think they would be, I think there's a lot more intelligence involved in this. So put aside the superdelegates. I don't even know why they get mentioned in the context of sort of news reports on the delegate count. Right now, the delegate count is almost even. And Clinton's up by like 2 or 3 delegates. Now, there's very few delegates that have been awarded at this point. But with this kind of money, Bernie Sanders is going to stay in the race. And, I mean, look, we can talk about the different arguments as to whether or not. The one that I find the most disingenuous at this point is this electability argument in the general election. First of all, to the extent that there's any data on electability, Sanders is just as electable as Clinton. In some instances, some polls say more. Then the argument goes, but we don't know what happens. We don't know when the Republicans start attacking Bernie Sanders as being a socialist and for writing kooky things when he was in college and being old, I guess, or I don't know what. And Hillary Clinton, has already been tested, has already been attacked. Well, one, that's all speculation. All right, let's just understand that right now. That is completely speculative. No one knows the efficacy of attacks that could come from the Republican Party on Bernie Sanders. And to the extent that we even have a sense of the efficacy of those attacks on Hillary Clinton, we don't know how that plays out in a general. We just don't. We can look at unfavorables now, and they do not favor Hillary Clinton. I have my own theory about who matches up against Trump. And again, it's completely speculative. But no more or less speculative than the idea of how Bernie Sanders will be attacked. I happen to think that Bernie Sanders, that they both can beat Donald Trump, but I happen to think that Bernie Sanders would be a much tougher candidate for Donald Trump to attack in a general election. We'll talk about that later. But like I say, I think both of them can win. I don't know that I'm ready yet to engage in the debates about people who are saying Bernie or bust or Hillary or bust for that matter. But we'll get there soon enough, one way or another. Also, last night I was on Chris Hayes's program. And we're going to play that clip in a moment because it apparently I offended the PC police who support Donald Trump. Apparently I really pissed them off. But of course, when I go on Chris Hayes's program, it gives me an opportunity to shave. I usually don't like to shave. Gives me an opportunity to use my Harry's razors. And look, everybody knows that good things come in sets of three. Are we right? Look, there's three of us plus one in this office.
It's true. Three GOP candidates.
There are three GOP candidates plus the other two.
And look, it's a fantastic point.
Well, what does this have to do with anything? I will tell you. March is the third month of the year. It also happens to be our friends over at Harry's 3-year anniversary as a business. And if you're new to Harry's, I've got a special deal for you. Try three of their expertly crafted 5-blade German razors, which is just two more than three, and a shave cream for just $10. That's right. Harry's gives me the best shave I think I've probably ever had. Now, I've never been a big shaver, but, and I don't know if it's a function of like, because I'm shaving like only like every 3 days or something like that, but their blades are super sharp, super comfortable, and they don't cost an arm and a leg, of which most people have four, which is one more than three. They have both amazing quality and low prices. They mail it right to your house. Why pay $32 for an eight pack of blades when you can get them for half the price at harrys.com? The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razors. But Harry's will give you $5 off your first order with promo code MajorityReport. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to harrys.com right now. That's harrys.com. Enter code MajorityReport at checkout. All right, let's play this.
We love those people at Harry's. Don't we love
Harry's? I actually do love Harry's.
Don't we love Harry's?
And Harry's loves me too.
Look, they're fantastic.
Now look, listen. Last night I went on Chris Hayes's program. Charlie Pierce was on. Hayes and I and Charlie Pierce. And I was expressing my perspective on whether or not Donald Trump will play to all of America. And this is what I said.
Joining me now, Sam Seder, host of The Majority Report and an MSNBC contributor, and Charlie Pierce, writer-at-large for Esquire magazine. So this is the question. I had a birthday party this weekend, a bunch of friends I was talking to, folks who are not news junkies, but are pretty politically informed.
Pause it.
And this is what everyone wants.
Just occurs to me I was not invited. I don't know if
first
it was
thing I thought of. What
yeah,
the hell?
I don't know. I got to talk to him about that. Maybe it wasn't his birthday party. If it was his birthday party, I'm a little bit offended. All right, but go ahead.
So, no, what do I want to see here? If I'm not a Republican, if I am on the other part of the political spectrum, Sam, what's your feeling?
You know, I'm glad that what I want doesn't necessarily always come true. Because I'm terrified at the idea that Donald Trump could be the president of the United States. And of course, if he becomes the nominee of the Republican Party, he's one step closer. But I gotta think that at the end of the day, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, that the American public is just going to, broadly speaking, reject him. I mean, I think he's doing well with Republicans, but I don't think he's doing well necessarily with normal people. And I think that to a large extent, it's going to hurt down ticket a lot more than any other Republican candidate.
Now, Hayes was in Texas at the time. And when we cut back, when I could see him on screen, because they roll tape, it did look to me like he almost was cracking up. And as I said that line, I was like, wow, you know, this is a little bit aggressive for me to say on the Majority Report. MSNBC. But I do think it's the case. Now, there was a lot of whiny, frankly, weak, and I'm sad to say that because I love people on Twitter. And I really, it does. It hurts me to say that because I love people on Twitter. And I love people who have low follower accounts on Twitter. And those people love me. Low follower account Twitter handlers, they love me.
We
and
love,
I love
low
them.
Followers.
They're
don't
great.
We love low followers?
No, I love them. But I have to say, it's sad for me to say this, they were sad and pathetic. They were sad and pathetic in the way they responded to me. They were, first off, I will tell you that my headset, my hearing on the show, I could barely hear anything. And that's why I got confused when I said, but it's true. That's the other thing, is it's true. And I think it's just weak and sad when low followers on Twitter complain about me being PC, because I'm not PC. I'm against PC-ness. Those Trump, they want to tell me that it's not normal, that it's...
They were upset that you were making a normative argument over who to vote for.
Yeah, I don't know who they want me to call normal or not normal, but I'm not beholden to anybody. And they can't, you know. So it's sad. I mean, I hate
You're
to say
asking
that.
Me to look up who's normal and not normal.
Perhaps
if you gave me a list of people, Chris,
right.
I could find out who's normal and not normal.
Yeah, how could
but
I know?
But it would be unfair for me to call Republicans normal without knowing more.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they don't want to be normal. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. I recorded this interview with Bobby Kennedy yesterday on a piece he wrote in Politico about Syria, and there was a bit of history that I was not aware of. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program my co-host from Ring of Fire, and you may know him from other places as well, Robert Kennedy Jr. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Happy to be here.
So I want to talk to you about this piece that you've written in Politico, because this part of history of our involvement in the Middle East, I think, is we never hear. I mean, you know, we occasionally we hear about our involvement in Iran in terms of the Shah, but we never hear this in terms of Syria. And your piece is entitled "Why the Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria." Let's start with the idea of just when we talk about the Arabs. I mean, who are we talking about here?
Well, you're talking about most of the people in the Mideast, except for Israel and Iran, which, of course, is not Arab. But as most Americans know by now, there are two major Muslim sects that kind of dominate the politics of the Mideast and create the fault lines. And this wasn't always true. There was always religious differences, but there wasn't outright war between those two sects, between the Sunnis and the Shia. And in fact, in Iran, in Iraq, prior to the war, there was not that kind of divisive fault line. We really created that fault line. When we went into Iran, we got rid of, Paul Bremer made this infamous decision to retire the entire army, which was mainly Sunni, and to fire anybody who was a member of the Ba'athist Party, which was largely Sunni and which controlled so that meant they fired every school teacher, every minister, all the government bureaucrats, the people who knew how to run a government. So suddenly you have these very capable people who were excluded from power, who were excluded from any kind of economic benefits to the society, who were very well armed and trained and had very strong leadership capacity, and they started what is known as the Sunni uprising. They later consolidated in a group that they called Al-Qaeda Iraq, and that group is now known as ISIS. So in that sense, we created ISIS by firing all the Sunnis. Oh, we did more than that. And what I show in the piece, there's kind of two sections of this piece. One is a history of American interventions in Syria, and the second part is the current crisis in Syria, which was really triggered by a pipeline war, a rivalry between two separate pipelines, one Sunni-controlled, the other Shia-controlled. And of course, the Sunni pipeline was the one that we supported, so we ended up helping to foment a Sunni revolution in Syria to ensure that this pipeline could be built from Qatar to Turkey.
Well, let's start with this idea. Let's start with the history, and then we'll talk about the pipeline, because this history, I think, is largely lost. I mean, we hear none of the involvement that we have had in Syria discussed whatsoever, I think, in the corporate media.
Right, and Syria today is really the political landscapes in Syria today are really the product of a series of violent interventions made by the CIA in the early history of modern Syria, that is, after World War II. Syria was, before World War II, a French colony. And the Syrians rose up against the French during World War II, against the Vichy government of France, which was, of course, controlled by the Nazis. So they were revolting against the Nazis and fighting alongside U.S. and British interests and the Allies. And during the war, it should be remembered, in 1941, as a precondition to America getting into the war, Franklin Roosevelt had forced Winston Churchill to sign the Atlantic, to endorse and sign the Atlantic Charter. The Atlantic Charter was an agreement among all the Allied nations about what the world would look like after World War II, after we presumably beat the Nazis. And what Roosevelt insisted was that the European nations withdraw from their colonies and give sovereignty to their colonies in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. Oh, Churchill didn't want to sign it, but he was forced to sign it. And it was really kind of a shining moment in American history of us reminding ourselves that we were once a colony, and that we had fellowship with the other colonies of the world, and that our objective was that the people of each nation should be sovereign unto themselves, and that the Arabs specifically should govern Arabia. Oh, after World War II, the French were forced to withdraw from Syria, and the Syrians tried to create their own democracy. They elected a president named Shukri al-Kuwaiti in 1949, and they had a democracy that was based upon the American model. They made a big mistake, which was they refused to, al-Kuwaiti canceled a pipeline that was called the Trans-Arabian Pipeline. It was an American project. This got the Dulles brothers mad at him, and they overthrew him in a coup. So that was, you know, everybody thinks that the Mossadegh coup and then the Guatemala coup by the, against democratically elected governments in Iran and Guatemala, Joseph Arbenz's government in 53 and 54 were the first CIA experiments with coup. But in fact, Syria was. That was the first place we went in and overthrew a democratically elected government.
And we should say, let me just, for folks who don't know, when you say the Dulles brothers, you're talking about the CIA director, Alan Dulles, and the Secretary of State,
John Foster Dulles. And actually, Truman didn't know this was going on. And Truman stopped Alan Dulles from overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran. He ordered him not to do it because the British had proposed that we join in on their coup against Mossadegh. Mossadegh caught the British and expelled them, but he refused to take the advice of his advisors that he also expel the CIA. And because he thought, he just thought America was, you know, was aligned with him, with his idealism, and he thought they were our country was incapable of those kind of perfidies. But in fact, as soon as Eisenhower came in, he allowed Dulles to go overthrow Mossadegh, who had, you know, who was interfering with oil deals that the Dulles brothers were interested in, particularly involving former clients of theirs at Sullivan Cromwell. The same as United Fruit, incidentally, was his former client of Sullivan Cromwell and the Dulles brothers when they overthrew Joseph Arbenz after he nationalized United Fruit's lands in Guatemala. But that's a different story. They went and overthrew Mossadegh, and a lot of people, as soon as Eisenhower came in, a lot of people think that that was their first coup, but their first coup actually occurred in Syria in 1949. The Syrians regrouped, and al-Kuwaiti was reelected, but now he was leery of America, and he moved to slightly to the left and began talking with the Soviets. And Alan Dulles sent Kim Roosevelt and Rocky Stone, who are the two wizards of coup wizards at the CIA, the two guys who had overthrown Mossadegh. He sent them to Syria with $3 million to bribe Syrian military officers to overthrow al-Kuwaiti, but instead, and to murder the chief of intelligence. Instead, they turned the money over and told on Stone and Roosevelt. Stone was arrested. He was roughed up and made a full confession of his role in both coups on national TV in Syria. There were riots all over the Arab world, but the American president and Eisenhower denied everything, and so Americans believed it. The New York Times believed it. Everybody believed it. But on the Arab street, and we forgot about it, but on the Arab street, people remember it to this day, and it's part of the American legacy. And that coup, all American diplomats were expelled from Syria. It was the first time that had ever happened with an Arab nation. Syria moved to the left, formed an alliance with the Soviet Union, and Bashar Assad is the legacy of that alliance. The Syrians have remained allied with the Soviets since that time. And that's the reason that we really want to get rid of them, because Bashar Assad in 2001 announced that he would not allow the construction of the Qatari pipeline through his nation.
All right, so hold on. So, Bobby, let me just recap a little bit here. So there was widespread awareness in the Arab world that we had been engaging the same thing that we had done with Iran, or would do with Iran, I guess. We had basically toppled a Syrian government or attempted a coup, and then we came back.
We did a coup in 49, and then we attempted a failed coup in 56 that was highly publicized and that everybody in Syria was well aware of.
And
the coup in Iran, just to put it in perspective, was in 53. So, and everybody in the Arab world in the Middle East knew about our role in the coup in Iran. They knew about our role in the, you know, in the Middle East. My uncle made a famous speech in 1956, which is still, you know, has made him still a hero in the Arab world, where he condemned all these actions. And he said, you know, we need to let the Arabs run Arabia. What are we doing over there with these violent interventions? The people all over, there was riots all over Northern Africa and the Middle East, and America never took notice of them. And people wondered, you know, where's all this anti-Americanism coming from? You know, we looked at ourselves as a benevolent force in the world, and they thought, well, these people are just crazy. But, you know, it's not that they hate us for our freedoms. They hated us because we were overthrowing their government and compromising our own ideals, you know, and our stated ideal love of democracy in their countries.
And so when we engage in this, and we're, like you had mentioned earlier, we're engaging this because of a determination. And I imagine it goes this way, right, where the Dulles brothers, it's not just a question of they have financial interests or they have friends that have financial interests in one pipeline project over another, and one that happens to enrich and empower the Sunni population. It's also a function of they believe their buddies when their buddies make the argument that this is in America's vital security and national interests.
Well, yeah, and to them, you know, to the Dulles brothers, if you read, and there's a terrific new book out about Alan Dulles called The Devil's Chessboard. And then another one by Timothy Weiner called Legacy of Ashes that really paint a picture. And, you know, these were old school Wall Street, stalwarts. During the Great Depression, when FDR was trying to, you know, made my grandfather head of the SEC and was trying to make Wall Street more transparent, Alan Dulles gathered all of his clients, his big J.P. Morgan and, you know, all of the big Wall Street clients in his law firm. And he said, you must resist him. If he orders you, if he passes a law, break the law. If they pass regulations, disobey them. Resist at all costs. Do not comply, and we will prevail. And that was his advice, and that's who he was. So they really saw America's destiny in the world as inseparable from the mercantile interests of America's largest corporations abroad.
And so what happens in terms of how does the sort of the dynamic between Sunni and Shia and the radicalization, the extremist groups that become that grow out of this, and particularly the Sunni groups. Where does that start to kick in? I mean, how much of our involvement at that time accelerated or became a catalyst for this level of extremism?
Well, you know, I would say kind of that they, of course, the big intervention was the first Gulf War, and that's where we stationed, you know, the legacy of that Gulf War is that we stationed, we put bases for the first time in Saudi Arabia. And that was the justification that Osama bin Laden gave for bombing the World Trade Center, was that, you know, the idea of having a foreign army in the sacred home of Mecca was anathema to his religious beliefs, and to, and it was an affront and a humiliation to every Muslim in the world. I would say that's where the cracks became chasms. And then, you know, during our invasion, we made a mistake of invading Iraq, which had never, you know, which had not done anything to us. And when we invaded, we put big troop deployments around the oil installations, but we did not protect the National Museum or any of the cultural or economic centers of gravity of the nation. And we fired all of the Sunnis who, you know, there was nothing anti-American prior to that about Sunnis in Iraq. But we created an entire army of people who really had no hope other than to, you know, to come in and, you know, begin attacking America and our interests. So that group then, and then we switched sides when we went after Syria, because Syria is governed by the Assad family, which is a small Muslim sect called the Alawite. And they are perceived, although they don't consider themselves, but they're perceived as allied more with the Shia than with the Sunnis. But in fact, Bashar Assad had a very diverse country. 80% of the army was Sunni. There was a lot of intermarriage between Sunnis and Shiites. They didn't have, there were probably half or more of the jobs in government were Sunni, so they didn't have this. They didn't have a major division between Sunni and Shiite, where they were at each other's throats prior to our intervention, and then there came the pipeline.
And so, let's jump ahead to where we are now. I mean, give me your sense of. Is there anything at this point that we can do beyond, I guess, what John Kerry has? And as we speak, you know, there's a tentative, I guess, ceasefire is the best case, is sort of the best way to characterize it. I mean, is this one of those situations where there's just not that much of a role that we can play here, or... because on some level, right, this is a Humpty Dumpty situation.
The problem is that we don't really have a clear objective. You know, we got into the war in Syria claiming to the American people that it was a humanitarian effort to oust a terrible dictator, which, as you know, there's problems with that because we only seem to oust dictators when they're sitting on top of our oil, right? There's a lot of worse dictators in the world, particularly than Bashar Assad. Bashar Assad is kind of an odd figure. He was never groomed for governance. His elder brother was supposed to take over after their father, who was a very brutal dictator. But the older brother was killed in a car accident, and Bashar Assad was studying to be a doctor in England, and he's a very cultivated, kind of charming, articulate guy who never really wanted to be in government. He was brought back, sent into the army for 2 years, and then essentially made the head of the country. And, you know, but it was, compared to some of the other places in the Mideast, it was humane. As I said, it was very diverse. He was, you know, he was increasingly moving toward the West. He was allowing the internet in the country and ATM machines and trying to modernize the country. They, you know, there's probably was torture there before the war. But it wasn't like Saudi Arabia where they, you know, they were, you know, they're where they behead people every Wednesday in the middle of Mecca, and they won't let women drive, and you go to jail if you try to do that. And, you know, it was a very free country compared to many of its Sunni neighbors. So it's not a real justification that we were going in there to, you know, prevent a humanitarian crisis. The real reason for our involvement, and this goes to your question, because, you know, the question is, what's our role now, is that in 2000, the Qatar government announced its proposal to build a pipeline that would connect Qatar to Turkey, and by going through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria. Now, this would change the whole geopolitical dynamic of energy distribution in Europe and the world. Right now, Europe's natural gas comes from Russia, largely. 30% of the gas comes from Russia, and Russia really has a chokehold on the European economies, and it's able to keep the prices high and leverage it for leverage its control of the supply for political advantage. Yeah, the pipelines go through Turkey and through the Ukraine, which was one of the reasons for the Ukraine war. But the Turks don't really like the Russians. They have a long historical rivalry with them. And so they like the idea of having Qatar, which has the biggest natural gas deposits on Earth. Qatar can't get its gas to market except by liquefying it and shipping it, which raises the price and lowers the supply. So if they built a pipeline, they could flood Europe with cheap gas. It was an existential threat to the Russians. It would kill them, and it would give domination to the Sunni countries of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and the Emirates. And so, in 2009, Bashar Assad said, in consideration of our Russian allies, we're not going to let them build the pipeline through our section of Syria, which killed the pipeline. That's when the CIA, the French, the British, and the Sunni nations all began fomenting a Sunni revolution in Syria. So they trained the Sunnis that were part of Al-Qaeda Iraq, that we had created this monster, and they sent them into Syria. And they trained Syrian Sunnis to revolt against Bashar Assad. And as early as 2006, a secret Pentagon report that was released by WikiLeaks said that if we continue to fund this Sunni revolution in Syria, there is a strong chance that the Syrians will break off and create an Islamic caliphate in the nation, and this is the purpose of our funding. Well, the Pentagon was endorsing what would later become ISIS, and we were giving weapons. We were training them at our bases in Qatar. The Qataris, who had the most at stake, put $3 billion into the Sunni revolution, which would become ISIS. And we shipped weapons through Turkey. We shipped them weapons through Libya. And we essentially weaponized and funded this revolt against Bashar Assad that has turned now into ISIS.
I know you just have a minute or two left. I mean, so... I mean, it sort of with that level of involvement, it really depends on saying what is the prescription. I mean, what is the what should we be doing as a country? Is we're having two different conversations, right? It's one is what do we think as people who are not involved in those machinations? I mean, is this a program that continues on?
What we have to understand is this began as a pipeline war. You know, it's morphed now into something much larger than that. But if you look at the history of our interventions, violent interventions in the Mideast since 1949, every one of them, everyone without exception, has ended in catastrophic blowback that was much worse than it caused problems that are much worse than any problem we went in to solve. And, you know, if you look at the New York Times this week, there's the headlines are about Hillary's intervention in Libya to get rid of Muammar Gaddafi, which has now resulted in an ISIS takeover of Libya. So every time we do one of these interventions, it just makes things worse. And the you know, there is so much intelligence now and so much overt recognition of the fact that one of the principal objectives, strategic objectives of ISIS is to accelerate and amplify the American military involvement, because that provides them with recruits. And if you put yourself in the shoes of a typical Syrian, you know, what are they, you know, what does the American intervention mean to them? They're never going to embrace us there. They Right. know what our history was, and, you know, and they, and you see, you know, one of the things that one of the, a former CIA chief told me, that, you know, I quote in this article, is that, and he was the liaison between the Iraqi and the intelligence and the U.S. intelligence and the Iraqi army during the, you know, between 2008 and 2012. He said to me, in Iraq, we never saw military age men fleeing the country like we are in Syria. And the explanation for that is the reason they're all leaving and not staying to fight is we haven't given them anything to fight for. You know, this is our war. It's a pipeline war between us. It's a geopolitical struggle between us and the Russians and Iran. And there's nothing in that formula that allows for a vision for that is created and crafted by the Syrian people that is worth sending their kids to die for. You know, it's just, it's a geopolitical war over pipelines, and who wants to fight for that?
On that note, Bobby Kennedy, the piece is in Politico, Why the Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria. I will link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today, Bobby.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right. We will link to that piece on majority.fm. Always great to talk to Bobby. And if you want more, he's not on every week on Ring of Fire, but most weeks. And Bobby has the ability to get just about anybody on the phone. So always a great interview with Bobby. You can sign up for the free Ring of Fire podcast account at rofpodcast.com. Speaking of podcast, ladies and gentlemen, this is a podcast, but when was it that we had Tina on? I don't know. I guess I'll ask her. But maybe it was about a year ago. Tina Dupuy came on after a short piece on This American Life about her experience of finding out that she wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. She went into AA as a young child and had always assumed that she had a drinking problem. But in fact, she had other problems. And that largely it was because her parents were in a cult. And so she is now doing a podcast about cults. And we're going to take a quick break, have her on just to tell us about that for a minute or two before we get back to the stories of the day, of course, on this superb Tuesday. Super Tuesday. All right, we'll be right back after this. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, ladies and gentlemen, the proprietor of a new podcast, which was released today. I'm looking at it right now. A wonderful little, it's nice little logo and purple background. Cultish, hosted by Tina Dupuy. Hello, Tina Dupuy.
Hello, Sam Seder.
So,
how are you?
Congratulations.
Thank you. This is really, really exciting.
I mean, it is exciting.
You've been such a huge part of actually making this happen. I mean, I really want to thank you. This, you know, you, I'm sure your listeners are aware of this, but you put up, you gave us 31-month subscriptions for some of our backers, which really helped us to actually get the money and from Kickstarter and raise enough funds in order to do this thing right.
Let me clarify.
You know,
not
I mean, you've been
a
amazing.
31 month free. It was 31 month free.
31 month. There was a comma there that
right.
didn't quite come across. But yes. No, you've been incredibly kind and generous with your time. And I don't know if we could have done it without you.
Well, the show better be good. I'm very excited.
I know. It really should. I really should.
Tell us, I know that you have an intro, you've posted an introduction to the show. I haven't listened to any of it yet, and I apologize, but it just came up last night, so what do you want out of me? there's a 3-minute introduction, I see, and then you've already put up episode 1 and 2. Very smart of you to put up both, because I think people are going to want more. First off, tell us what the show is, broadly speaking, and then I'll ask you about Nate Phelps, whoever that is, and Ben Franklin, whoever that is.
Well, it's an investigative serial podcast. So we have vignettes every episode. We talk to people who have cultish experiences, and then we're taking an entire season to tell one story. This season is about my uncle, who is one of the top leaders of the cult that I was born in, called the Children of God. And so we are fleshing out what his plight was and what he went through, which has never been told before. Their first episode, we have a defector from the Westboro Baptist Church, one of Fred Phelps's sons, Nate Phelps, who now is an LGBT advocate and an atheist. He works at Center for Inquiry in Canada. And it is... We had this incredible interview. I mean, this guy is such a sage, but he has this incredible story to tell about what it's like to grow up in, you know, the most hated family in America.
Wait, so wait a second. So you both do two things in each podcast. We introduce you. Mm-hmm. We meet someone who's sort of like, I guess, escaped a cult in some way. I don't know if that's the right.
Or someone who has a cultish experience, someone who has, we interviewed Nate. I also interviewed Jerry Minor, who was on SNL, but for our purposes, he was also on the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. I interviewed him. This is coming up this season. He was a Jehovah's Witness. And so we have people
I don't think
who,
I knew that. I know Jerry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he contacted me. I had a piece come out in Skeptic Magazine, and he contacted me and wanted to talk to me. So I was in L.A., and we sat down for about 4 hours. It's pretty incredible. He's amazing.
Wow. I've had experiences with Jehovah's Witnesses. They showed up at my door, and this was back, you know, when I would, you know, had more time. And literally, they had to say, okay, we've got to go now.
Well, that was what Jerry was saying. They don't go and knock on doors anymore because they don't want to do that because it was unpopular, not from the people who were who were getting harassed, but from the Jehovah's Witnesses. They just thought this was excruciating for them, so they stopped the practice.
Oh, I had no idea. I mean, for me, I was very welcoming. I was like, let's talk about this. I've got actually 4 or 5 hours to kill. And it was, I don't think I had cable at the time. So I was like, this is great. You guys show up tomorrow. And they just, they sort of walked away. And they seemed nervous, actually, after our exchange. So how many episodes are you going to do to tell this story of your uncle? Now, your parents were in it and your uncle? I mean, was your entire, I mean, when you go home for Thanksgiving, well, I mean, is that what?
They're very close knit. No. So my uncle was one of the top leaders. My parents were rank and file. My parents met in the Children of God, and I was born in the Children of God. They called us new bottles. But my uncle was one of the, he was in the top echelon of this cult.
Is your uncle on your mom's side or your dad's side?
This is my dad's side.
So your uncle was in the top leadership and his brother joined the cult, and that's where he met his wife. And that's how you came about.
Correct.
Wow. All right. Well,
yeah, so it is.
Are you excited? You seem nervous about the whole thing.
I am nervous. I'm terrified. This is perhaps the first time that I have really talked about this publicly. The first episode has...
Wait a second. You came on our show and you talked about it.
Well, yeah,
and then you did a little thing on that American Life, whatever that is.
That was about me, but the first episode is...
That show is okay, but I mean, the truth is, I mean, why this American Life? Why not that American Life? I don't know.
The first episode, this is why I'm nervous, Sam. The first episode, this is infamous. My uncle went on Larry King Live in 1993 and told the entire nation that he had had sex with a 10-year-old because the cult forced him to do that. And so it's reexamining why he said that, what that meant, and what he was trying to do with this kind of stunning revelation on national television. I mean, I remember when I was I went on a date in the 90s, and when I told the guy that I was, I was born in some weird cult, he actually knew exactly who my uncle was because he had seen the Larry King Live segment.
Oh, weird.
So, right, exactly.
How did the rest of that date go?
It kind of went a little bit downhill from there. Where do you go from there? That's in the first episode, and this is the story that we're really getting into because I've gotten hundreds of emails over the last 20 years about my uncle because we have the same last name, and so and several languages, by the way, of people who wanted to talk to me about him, and so it's really telling his story and what he went through and his kind of. His experience with what he called cult-related abuse.
Weird. And so then who's Ben Franklin? Not the Ben Franklin that, not the guy.
Well, you have to listen to it. No, it's the Ben Franklin effect. It's actually a psychological tick that we all have that 300 years before cognitive dissonance theory, Ben Franklin figured out how to make people like him. So that's the teaser. You have to listen to the episode.
Oh, all right. Well, you know what? I will.
This is, you did this, I am incredibly grateful to have a friend like you who could help me walk me through this because this was, I made tons of rookie mistakes. I had never fundraised before. You've definitely helped me with that. I had no idea how to actually syndicate a podcast, and you have spent so much time with me to make sure that this went smoothly today. I really thank you so much, Sam.
Well, my pleasure. I'm very excited that this thing exists. And I honestly am very excited to listen to it. Tina Dupuy, the podcast is Cultish. Do you have a website or anything, or do you just go right to...
Cultish.org.
What is it?
Cultish.org. Cultish.org. So you can search for us on iTunes. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/cultish. Cultish Podcast on Twitter. Follow us.
Now,
like
Tina,
review us.
On your show, did you ask people at the end, like, if you like the show, to give me a good rating and review?
Of course.
Because
I
that's
because
very
you
important.
Told me to do that.
I know that our
but
listeners know this.
That.
Yeah, okay, good. I wasn't sure if I had remembered to do that because that's really important. Folks, if you like the podcast and you want it to get out there, the best thing you can do for any of the podcasts that you like, for that matter, is to leave a rating and a review. It only takes a couple of minutes, not even 60 seconds, and it makes a big difference. So do it if you listen on like Stitcher or Podcast Alley, but if you do it on iTunes, that's the most helpful for the podcast. So good luck with this, Tina. Keep me updated. I will be in touch after I listen. Unless I really don't like it. I mean, then it would be
I need you to lie to me if you don't like it.
Of course I will. Of course.
That's the deal.
You got it.
Tina,
look, hold on for one second.
Fantastic podcast. It's true. Did a great job.
What was that?
Yeah, Michael has to chime in with Trump voice for everything now.
That's true.
It's a real problem.
It's a tremendous point.
All right. Tina.
Boning up on his outer borough boat, brogue.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Cultish.org.
We love the cult people, don't we? They're great. They're great.
Thank you, boys.
Bye, Tina.
Bye.
Tina Dupuy, everybody. Tina Dupuy. The podcast is Cultish, and you can check it out at cultish.org. Folks, you know, we don't have the broad appeal that Tina Dupuy's podcast is going to have. Because, I mean, everybody likes a good story about cults. Everybody. Not everybody likes a good story about politics. I mean, this time of year, in this era right now, where we are right now, you know, Hayes was talking about, he started that segment, he goes to a birthday party that apparently I was not invited to. And people are asking him, like, who would we want to win the primary? Now, you know, people start getting interested in that. But, you know, this program, we've been obviously following the campaign a healthy amount. I mean, that's what we do this time of year and this cycle and whatnot. But our mission still remains to have really interesting conversations with people that you wouldn't otherwise hear from and in a length that you wouldn't normally get on the political talk shows. And, you know, let's face it, it's no secret that the one major sort of outlet for liberal talk, be that as it may, MSNBC is making a very self-conscious and decision to reorient itself. I mean, I don't know anything other than what I read, and the fact that when I go into the to go to the studio, it just seems like I don't know any of these people anymore. Like, they've taken down all the pictures of all the people. I do remember the time where I went in there, and in the green room, they had sketched the photographs of, like, the primetime hosts. And it was after Olbermann had been fired, and it was just, like, four pictures that were supposed to be up there, and there was just one missing. It was pretty crazy. In retrospect, I should have stolen them. Folks, my point is that this program is funded by our members. 98%. And so when you become a member, what we do is we give you an extra show every day. Bonus material. Every day as a way of saying thank you. And we give you the first half without commercials. It's not like we've got that many commercials, but, you know, it's better than a stick in the eye. So if you can become a member, go to jointhemajorityreport.com today. If you want access to the fun hour, not really an hour, asterisk. If you want access to that, but you cannot afford it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We never not accommodate. Don't accommodate. We never refuse to accommodate. We look forward to accommodating anybody who's interested in the rest of the show but doesn't have the financial means to do so. We never shut anybody out because of financial reasons. But if you're one of those people...
No matter what Matt says.
But if you're one of those people who are fortunate enough not to have that issue and you want to support the program and or you want the extra material... JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. If you drink coffee, this is the way you should do it. You buy it by either ground or whole bean from a co-op that delivers it directly to your door. Free shipping. Coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Tell your friends. Tell your enemies. It's even better. And if you buy crap from Amazon or... Jet.com, You can do it at majorityreportkickback.com. Just click on the links there, bookmark them. Always buy your stuff through there, and we get a little kickback. All right, going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. Take your phone calls. Take your IMs. We've got some sound. Tonight, I will be part of TYT's YouTube coverage of Superb Tuesday, as I call it. I've changed the name of it. What's that?
The Sargon thing.
Oh. You
probably plug that.
Oh, right. Yeah, folks, stick around. At 4:30 today.
4:30.
Michael is going to be debating a figure from the Middle Earth, is it? Or where are they from?
Middle Earth.
I don't indeed. Know. Sargon.
Sargon will tell you about regressive leftists.
We'll do it live, but we'll end up, certainly members will get the podcast. But it'll also be on YouTube.
Yes, indeed.
Sargon. I challenge you.
I honestly don't know if there's going to be any type of voting process for like who you want to win, but if he brings out a sword, he's got my vote. That's it. I'm just telling you. If he actually brings out a weapon. Yeah. I don't even think he has to argue with anything. If he does that, if he wears like a full on, what era is Sargon from? If he wears the full on sort of armor or stuff like that, not, I don't think it's actual armor, but like a leather, like harness across his chest.
Well, I shouldn't say this, but I would forfeit the match at that point.
Of course.
I shouldn't let this out.
Very weak. Very weak.
Well, I mean, I'm also just being respectful.
Very weak. Very sad.
Look,
he's a better. He's the. He's
look, frankly, it's pathetic.
He's a better warrior. All right, we'll be back in a second.